Okay, recorder's on. This is World Affairs Monthly, and I have Mr. Kurt Doolittle on the line. He is a philosopher, a moral philosopher, and a scientist, and he's the founder of the Proprietarian Institute. I'm sorry, I probably really stumble on it. Proprietarian Institute, and that can be found on the net at proprietarianinstitute.com. Kurt, it's really great to have you on the line, and as I just explained, I was hoping you could introduce us to how you came to realize that, of course, we all know historians have documented this. Civilizations or human societies the past couple of thousand years have gone up and then they go down. And, you know, my son Christoph has been so impressed with you, and that's how I get introduce you. Check him out, Christoph Pachari, on Twitter and everywhere. But first question I have is introduce everything, but how would you explain the cultural and, of course, no doubt genetic influences that are playing a big role in this rise and then fall? So there we go, Kurt. You're free to talk.
Okay. How truthfully impolitic can I be?
Well, I think you should just say exactly what you want to say. Totally truthful. Yeah, totally.
So I'm going to make a couple of notes here to myself. The first is that we've talked a little bit about how humans evolved.
Right.
That just takes a little bit. That's a really simple
Yeah,
bit.
That's fascinating. Yeah.
All right. The second thing we have to talk about is the formation of the foundations of different civilizations.
Okay.
And
excellent.
That'll include the formation of a group strategy.
Okay.
And then the organization of institutions. In other words, there are only so many institutions human civilizations can develop, and the order in which that you develop them or groups choose them determines, it's sort of like anchoring you in a technology. The
okay.
same thing happens. And so you become anchored in that order, and you pretty much can't escape it. And thirdly, those choices are either more consistent and correspondent with the laws of the universe or less.
Excellent.
Those are the steps.
Okay.
The evolution of mankind and our differences, the foundation of civilization, and with our the foundation of each civilization according to its group evolutionary strategy,
yeah.
and the order of institutions that develop out of that group evolutionary strategy, and then finally how much those set of institutions correspond with reality or not.
Okay.
And that determines your rate of development, or conversely, your rate at which you stagnate, or worse, the rate at which you decline.
Okay.
So,
we could devote 20-minute interview to each of those, you know.
So, oh, right. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'll just
yeah.
I mean, do whatever you want
okay.
to cover.
Well, look, like I said, we know that historians have documented this. You know, they go up, civilizations go up, they go down. And one way to get you started is to describe the interplay between cultural effects and genetic effects. I mean, how powerful are those two?
How did you start that out? You said that civilizations rise and fall.
Yeah.
There is a pattern, but the pattern isn't the one. There are two patterns in the rise and fall of civilizations.
Okay.
One is that all human organizations tend to maximize rent-seeking to the point at which they can no longer adjust to shocks.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, there's no free capital to reorganize a society with. That's what happens. It doesn't matter if you're a family, you lose wealth in three generations. You're a corporation, you tend to lose it within one generation. You lose your competitive advantage in one generation. Or you look at a country, they tend to last about a one generational cycle, which is four generations.
Okay.
So these are normal effects of all social orders, all right?
That's right.
Every single human organization. So that's the first. The second is that there's been a conflict between civilizations since the Indo-European expansion, And that's what we're part of. We're part of the Western Indo-European expansion. The people in the middle are sort of gone, and India and Persia, or today's Iran, are what remain. However, as we see in India, they didn't go the same direction we did. They developed a caste system, and Iran went down and was eventually overwhelmed by the Arabization. So you have, but we are, we so so we have a conflict here, but this conflict is between the group strategy of the Indo-Europeans, which I can hopefully explain. I'd rather do it in the context of that long, those four steps I gave you, because I'll be less confused. But there's a conflict between the Indo-European method and the Semitic method of social organization.
I see.
Because their first institution is religion, and our first institution is what we think of as traditional common law, not like legislative law not that we have today, or not like command law that we that the French have or the Chinese have. The Chinese don't have law. They have a set of rules called commands.
Right.
But we had developed empirical law for reasons I think are most fascinating.
Yes,
to most.
Utterly fascinating, yes.
So the reason, this conflict is going through cycles as we try to bring in a different group evolutionary strategy into the Middle East, and the Middle East counters with their opposite group evolutionary strategy.
Yeah.
The difference is that ours is evolutionary and theirs is devolutionary.
Okay.
And so this causes a conflict. This is why China and India are, China is specifically prohibiting the expansion of Islam, and they're probably going to keep pushing it out. Russia is tolerating it, but making orthodoxy and Russian ethnicity the purpose of the state, and everyone else is tolerated.
Okay.
And India is at the very cusp of leaving behind the French and Russian socialist experiment and becoming nationalist again in order to stop the expansion of this primitive strategy into their culture.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, we are rather foolish and optimistic for reasons I can easily explain, and we are allowing this catastrophe into our civilization, where it will has destroyed every great civilization of the ancient world.
Now, identify that catastrophe again.
Islam, or basically the Abrahamic religions in general.
We
domesticated Christianity. We Germanicized Christianity during the Middle Ages, so it's not quite as primitive as it started out with.
Right.
But you know, certainly Islam is not a primitive strategy. It's a very advanced method of undermining societies from within in order to produce a race to the bottom.
I see.
And it's not a religion. It's a method of warfare.
Okay. Yeah. Interesting.
The Chinese are really become the fascists, right? They didn't copy the communists. They've become the fascists.
Yeah.
And that, which means they're hyper nationalist, militaristic, and expansionist. And they're doing it for the same reason the Germans did it, which is to resist the communists.
Yeah.
Except that the Chinese are resisting the Islam and what they see as the West as a softer version.
Sure. Now, how much of a threat do you think Islam is posing to China?
Well, in any civilization, there are some percentage of the population that are susceptible to false promises.
Okay.
Seduction into some sort of addiction.
Yeah.
Islam is extremely destructive to even the human mind.
Okay.
And certainly to knowledge, and it has destroyed North Africa, Egypt, the Levant, Mesopotamia, Persia, Northwest India, the Anatolians, the Greeks, the Byzantines, and it destroyed trade in Europe. Even if you look at the Turks, if they had not adapted Islam, they would be in a better position.
Yeah.
But you're asking me to address the big picture without setting the foundation.
Okay,
so
I'm sorry.
So if I set the foundation, you'll understand that these aren't opinions.
Okay.
They're physics.
No, I agree. They're not opinions. Now my son Christoph has always argued. He's 21 now. Brilliant boy. You'll have to talk to him. Now he's always told me, Tom, you know, I'm dad. IQ, you know, okay, maybe we have difficulty measuring IQ, but we try. IQ plays a huge role.
You don't have any difficulty measuring IQ. There's no difficulty measuring IQ.
Well, okay, defining IQ. Okay. You know, understanding what it really means.
What it means is your neural response time,
okay,
the rate at which your neurons adapt to changes in information.
Okay.
And so it's just physics. There's
okay.
nothing miraculous.
All right. I agree with you on that. I'm just kind of conceding the fact that it's, you know, human brain and human brain function is still pretty much a mystery. And
no,
you know,
it's not.
I
have videos on it. I can explain it all. Most of the revelations have happened
okay.
in the sciences over the past 10 years, and some of the most important ones in the past 3. But as far as I know, the question over the human mind versus the computer is settled. It's just a matter of making the having the same problem with the mind as we had with, or the brain and mind, as
okay.
we have with IQ, personality, and race.
Okay.
It's the same issue.
Now, Kurt, isn't it true, correct me if I'm wrong, but the Western European brains, you know, Cro-Magnon as the you know, progenitors of this, have a larger frontal cortex than, say,
so,
you know,
why don't you let me start out at
yeah.
the beginning?
Yeah, please.
All right? So let's put the foundation ahead because
okay.
it's just easier to stick with the science.
Yeah, sure.
Okay? So there are basically 4 generations of man, maybe 5. And the first generation is that the African baseline generation. Those people are still around in small numbers and what we think of as the Khoisan. There's the second generation of Africans, which is the people that evolved out of and spread out of the East African River Valley and produced the first group that went out across the southern Arabian Peninsula, across India, and down into the Austronesia, all right?
Yeah.
So we had this 2 generations. The third generation looks like it didn't go north like we thought, but it went, again, the same route and took advantage of the fact that the Persian Gulf used to be dry, it was pre the flood, mm-hmm. and was where civilization and the next generation of man evolved.
Mm-hmm.
The next, after that, we had a branch. We had the eastern branch go to the Tibetan Plateau, where it's very cold, and that is where the Asian Urhaimatas. And then you had another group either come out of the Persian Gulf or closer to India across the north of the Caspian and Balkans, and that becomes the Europeans.
Hmm.
The last generation is the ancestral North Eurasians, and that's only 25,000 years ago. And that's where you get what we look like today, or the Finns look like.
Hmm.
So we have these generations, and each of those generations, at least the first ones, are that the earliest Africans are in the 50 to 60 IQ range.
Mm-hmm.
The rest of them are in the 60 to 70 IQ range. The South Eurasians that start in the Persian Gulf and are now from the coast of North Africa to the west coast of Africa, North Africa, to the east coast of India. Those are the South Eurasians, and that's all below the Caspian and Black Sea.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, below the temperate lines. And then and those people have about an 84, 83, 45 distribution.
Okay.
And then the people up in the colder areas, the Europeans, have about a 100 distribution.
Mm-hmm.
And the people in East Asia have about 105 distribution.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it wasn't too hard to figure out what happened. What happened is called domestication syndrome,
mm-hmm.
or neoteny,
mm-hmm.
which is the decrease in aggression, or testosterone especially,
mm-hmm.
decrease in aggression in exchange for slower development,
okay.
including in utero, including in childhood,
mm-hmm.
including in sexual maturity, and including the depth of sexual maturity.
Okay.
So if you look at the races, the primary races, the African, the South Eurasian, West Eurasian, us Europeans, and the East Asians, that's a neotenic decline of increasing neoteny.
Mm.
What happens in neoteny is you get a bigger brain for more longer time,
right?
And you get more agency. What we think of as more frontal
okay.
self, more executive function.
Okay.
Is the problem.
Yeah. more self-control, et cetera. All the good things, actually. Yeah.
So this is just like domesticating breeds of any other animal.
Okay.
And that's the primary difference. All so is 115 IQ person from West Africa any different from 115 person from East Asia? There's a slight difference in, say, verbal versus spatial and memory skills in the races. There's certainly a difference between the Ashkenazi verbal skill and the European admixture. Okay. So each race has a little bit of different minor differences.
Right.
There are predictable differences in behavior. The more masculinized races, like the Africans, have more antisocial behavior, what we think of as criminality, and the East Asians have the least, and we're sort of in the middle.
Okay.
And all the rest of the races that we think about are just admixtures of those four groups.
Sure. Okay.
So and they have the predictable media, the predictable IQs between them, just like people who African Americans who've been in the country a long time are 20% white, and you look at their IQ statistics, and they're a mid range between Africans and white.
Yeah, yeah. Now,
and so there's no difference. So the whole thing is, we know the direction of evolution. The direction of evolution was possible through migration, isolation, stress, and the extraordinary value of stress in combination with cooperation, especially in colder climes.
Now, go ahead. I'm sorry to interrupt.
So really, there are four or five generations of us, four primary generations. Five if you could count the ancestral North Eurasians, but they're gone. They've been bred out. And then we've had the hybridization events we've had two major hybridization events, which were the agrarian dispersals from the Middle East and from China, and the Indo-European expansion from, Eastern Europe across between Spain and China, and the edge border of China.
Mm-hmm.
So those have been our hybridization events. The people we probably should separate out further is the Iranics, because there's a slight difference between the Persian Iranics and the Arabic or the Afro-Asiatic people and the people who are not Afro-Asiatic. And so those people have produced an admixture of what we call the Turks, which is an admixture of Asians and Iranics. Indians are an admixture of various generations of Iranics and, I guess, earlier peoples from the dispersal. So if you look at the world, everybody follows this predictable trend of cranial volume, degree of neoteny, and lower aggression.
Okay.
And
now,
so you see it. Now, the single measurement that matters is IQ.
Yeah. Okay. Now, Philip Rushton is obviously a pathbreaker in this, right? And I wanted to mention.
Well, he was right, but I mean, the problem with being right is when you're right.
Yeah.
He was right at a time that the reason that happened is the post-war movement of the Jewish movement, particularly the communist, neo-Marxist, and the later postmodernists, came to America with a deliberate plan to make, because they had failed in Europe with communism or authoritarianism. They failed because capitalism did work. The reason they came to America was because they knew perfectly well that capitalism couldn't fix the black problem.
Yeah.
So they've used, since the 60s, they've used the blacks as the tool by which to undermine our civilization from within, claiming that it's some sort of prejudice. And that's the reason for their war on data. Their war on the sciences is in order to preserve their false claims.
Fascinating. Now I just want to quickly mention.
And it's not like I'm deducing this. They wrote it down. They said what they were going to do. They came here. They did it. They spread it. They financed it. They perpetuate it. And it's been done. And the way they financed it, it's been brilliant. But they financed it and they've spread the message. So we're not in a situation where we're in an accident. They had the Christianization of Rome to destroy the Roman Empire the Christian destruction of the ancient world, just like we've had the Jewish destruction of the modern world.
Sure. I totally agree. Now, I don't mean to change the thread of the topic here, because we're going on 20 minutes and it's okay. Don't worry about it. But what about sexual dimorphism? My son and I have talked a lot about that. Isn't that pretty interesting?
Thing. Yeah. Well, it's the same thing. I mean, if you have you can increase sexual depth, and that looks like that happened in Africa. So you get the what we think of as I can't remember the name of the majority group in the middle, and they're stronger, they're more masculinized, and you'll see more masculine features even in the women. You'll see the same thing in the Austronesians. I mean, So you're going to get those more masculine features, and you're going to get more rapid development, and that's going to give you more body mass and strong and different feature sets. Whereas, and so one of the things that's going to, how did you just phrase the question? You said how
is my son and I have discussed sexual dimorphism.
Sexual dimorphism.
Yeah.
So what happens is you take sexual dimorphism down a little bit, and you get the Middle Eastern, which. Still have some strong facial features. You take it down further, and you get Anatolian and Greek. You take it further, and you get European. You take it down and furthest, you get in the European side, and you get the Finns. And if you go to East Asia, you take it down to the extreme, and you get the East Asian body type, which is why they live longer. They mature more slowly, they're much more pliable, and they have more learning. They have better learning abilities because, frankly, they're less mature. I mean, the difference between a wolf and a dog is that a wolf is incredibly aggressive and persistent,
yes.
And a dog isn't.
Yeah, sure.
Because a dog is basically an infant wolf.
Yeah.
The same way we're infant gorillas.
Yeah.
Sort of.
Yeah. Sure, neoteny. Once again, neoteny. Now the more advanced human animals have more sexual dimorphism. Is that correct or not?
Well, it's easier to see the sexual dimorphism in Europeans, but it goes to look at it in East Asians.
Yeah.
They've almost lost it.
Okay.
Right? So there's sort of like I always think of was the baby bear, mama bear, and daddy bear.
Yeah.
Well, you want the middle.
Okay.
And we're sort of in the middle,
yeah.
Right? We're still large. We're still strong. We still have high sexual dimorphism. We still have high neoteny. But we didn't go as far as the East Asian did. And the problem for us is that we seem to be paying a higher price in neuroticism.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know quite why that is, but it does explain white women.
Mm-hmm.
And so we pay a higher price in in neuroticism for some reason, even though we pay a lower price in much lower price in antisocial behavior.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So and we have almost no clannishness, which is the reason we're easily invaded.
Mm-hmm. Well, Kurt, it's really interesting. I was hoping you could summarize, I don't want to end the conversation right now necessarily, but I just want to keep it to limit to some reasonable time because otherwise it will be audio. Anyway, we can have several interviews.
Well, I mean, I can summarize three things.
Okay.
There is no longer any more dispute over biological differences. Race differences was solved in 19. Class differences quite a bit back before 2000. We're done.
Okay.
Right? That science is done. Right? We have it across the spectrum. There's enough of it. It's worldwide, blah, blah, blah.
Okay.
The second thing is there's no mystery about the origin and the distribution of talents between the races.
Okay.
It's well understood. We know the cause of it. We know why it happened. There's a minor debate over how much the weather mattered. And I don't think that's not a debate that matters. What matters is the difference is neoteny.
Okay.
And then the third dimension is why do civilizations develop what they do based on those factors?
Mm-hmm.
So those are the three things we need to understand.
Yeah.
And civilizations need to meet the demands of the demographic distribution they have. So of course you're going to see lower longer development in Africa. Although it started to happen in West Africa, you're going to see a religious and regressive place in the Middle East and in Central Asia. And you're going to see, because of the Indo-European expansion, you're going to see them try to escape it in India, but fail because they could. The Indo-Europeans weren't numerous enough to overcome the demographics, so they invented castes to prevent their admixture. Mm-hmm. You see, the Chinese, they just conquer and they conquer. They forcibly domesticate neighboring peoples, and they force them into the Han culture, which is what they should do. Mm-hmm. And what they, and frankly, they used the, they used under manorialism and credit, they basically got rid of the lower end. Mm-hmm. And Europeans, we did the same thing. We made people slaves if they were at the bottom, or under manorialism from 700 700 forward above the Haina line in Europe, we used manorialism, which meant you couldn't get access to farmland if you weren't married and of good character, yeah. And that basically eradicated the lower classes by the late Middle Ages.
Okay, yeah. In other words, the troublesome animals are removed, obviously.
Right. I mean, so yeah. The thing is, why did the left come to America and use America to undermine Western civilization?
Yeah.
That they came here on purpose because they knew that problem wasn't solvable.
Mm-hmm.
On our method, we made a terrible mistake of not sending the slaves back.
Mm-hmm.
The government wouldn't pay the cost of it.
Mm-hmm.
We were doing the right thing, which was letting them develop their own culture, and they were beginning to do it, and their middle class was emerging.
Mm-hmm.
What did the left do? They came in and used them as the Soviets did to relocate them to urban areas to destroy the voting capacity of those urban areas,
mm-hmm.
and look what's happened. They destroyed those areas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now they brought in immigrants, and they've used increased taxation in order to reduce native population rates of reproduction.
Mm-hmm.
So what we're doing is redistributing our reproduction to hostiles.
Sure. Now, how long do you think it will be before young people, you know, really across the board, all types, you know, lower income, higher income, all types of young people, understand everything that you were talking about right now? You know, because right now you go into a school and typical school in America, they're going to look at you like you're
crazy. The enemy has never failed.
Yeah.
What did I just say?
The enemy's never
failed. The enemy has never failed.
Yeah.
The only thing that happened is in England, they kicked the Muslims out of Spain, the Ottomans out of the Balkans, and they kicked the Jews out of England, and even the Russians gave up on the Jews.
Mm-hmm.
So the problem is, if you don't get rid of that idea, I mean, they're getting to the point where you have to get rid of the Catholic Church now because it's joined the enemy.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you have to understand that this is not a question of democracy.
Hmm. Yeah.
You can't leave it up to democratic control.
No, you can't.
Somebody's got to be responsible,
right,
and take ownership of the future of our civilization, and our people, and probably mankind, because that the part I skipped over in order to answer your questions quickly,
yeah,
is the evolution of civilizations, and you realize that everybody failed except us to discover the laws of nature.
Yeah.
And why did they do that?
Good
they
question.
Did it because they did it because the relationship, every civilization's foundation is based on the relationship between the military caste and the common people.
Mm-hmm.
Europeans conquered the domestic population of Europe, and treated them basically as cattle and domesticated them forcibly.
Mm-hmm.
Every other Indo-European group is gone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So what are the Chinese doing? They're doing the right thing.
Yeah.
We're not.
Okay. Sure.
Because no one else has done it. No one else no one else has practiced truth before face. No one else practices rule of law.
Yeah.
Nobody else practices testimony in court. No one else practices confession. No one else practices truth before face in the commons.
It's incredible. Yeah.
See, we talk about individualism. That's wrong. That's not what we do. We use the right to self-determination in order to direct the proceeds to the commons. We're the people that produce the commons,
yeah,
which is what we all look at. Europe is a vast open-air museum,
yeah,
because we can produce commons and everyone else freaking can't. And they made a choice thousands of years ago, and they're prisoners of it.
Mm-hmm. Well, isn't it true that when you do well, you breed the failures that are, you know, going to come? I mean, you kind of breed failures. Is that a good way to put it? You do well and create really great things, but this is going to destroy you.
There's no excuse.
Yeah.
There's no excuse.
Okay.
There's no excuse that conservatives get to say, oh, it's natural fate. That's bullshit.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. I agree with that.
That's complete bullshit. The only thing that stopped, we had the Civil War, we had the Revolutionary War, we had the English Revolution, and we had uprisings before that.
Okay.
The reason we succeed is we're a rule of law civilization, where all we do is change the Constitution, what we think of as the law, and we modify it in order to restore our rights. And so there's no excuse. Either you show up and you do the job that the founders did, and that's my work. My work just repeats the founders, or you're just a lazy piece of shit that deserves what you get.
Okay. Now, don't you think that it would have been a little different had the Ashkenazi Jews from the Pale of the Settlement come over here, a couple of million of them, between 1880 and 1920? I mean, hasn't their influence been, you know, quite extraordinary?
Well, they didn't matter. What mattered was the post-war Jews.
Okay.
You know, if you look at the Jewish population in certain parts of the country before the Second World War, it's very hard to tell from Presbyterians. Presbyterians being the sort of Scottish and English ruling class that sort of was running our financial sector. And there weren't any difference between them. I mean, you had Jews with Christmas trees, for Christ's sake. They just had six-pointed stars instead of five.
True, yeah.
So it was really, it's bringing the East European Jews and the ones that had already bought into the revolutionary model. You brought over the earlier Jews from, you know, from civilization. Sure, the Jewish group evolutionary strategy is purely parasitic, but they weren't a problem. What was the problem was, is that Hitler took the American progressive, frankly, eugenics movement over, and he said, well, it applies to the Jews, and he applied it to them. So what the Jews did is they took out what they are really great at, which is industrializing propaganda, and they conducted a war, an information warfare against truth.
Yeah.
So that's what the, you know, Marxism is a war, creates a warfare between the classes.
Yeah.
Feminism creates warfare between the sexes. Postmodernism denies truth exists. Woke and the PC, and then it was a war between the races. I mean, they just do what they did. They called it what they said they were going to do was destroy the institutions of cultural production. And they did.
Yeah,
and they're good at it because they're more willing to spend their money on it.
Yeah.
We can't get conservatives to show up for 3 days in order to issue demands.
That's right. Yeah. Well, it's really interesting, Kurt. I, you know what I'd like to do is, now, I think we've got a fairly good introduction. I don't know. I don't mean to cut you off, but how about this? How about this question before, you know, a couple of minutes more, and I can call you in a couple of days or a week and do the second. The international relations today appears to be quite, you know, simple compared to what, you know, maybe 30, 40, 50 years ago. Like, for example, you know, we had a lot of states going at it, you know, 40, 50 years ago, the United States and Civil Union, et cetera, et cetera. And today, you know, there's not much going on. I mean, for example...
That's a mistake. No,
well, just hear me out, though. You know, Nagorno-Karabakh, you know, the Armenians and the Azerbaijanis were having it out and killing each other for a little while, and it kind of petered out. And I don't know, you know, you just don't have that much all-out conflict. You got the Colombian Civil War, that's pretty much gone. You know, it seems to me, and my son has mentioned this, Christoph, is that weaponry is now pretty cheap and very powerful, and there's more and more parity. So people just don't fuck around with each other anymore.
Well, I mean, if I look at the hot zone map, I would say that the real answer is that there's some truth to what you're saying, but the Pax Americana is still in place.
Yes, it is.
And so that power vacuum is going to, what Trump was saying, is that power vacuum is going to fill and everybody's going to sprint for it.
Yeah.
So, and what we're worried about is China's going to sprint for it at the cost of our allies who produce technology we don't.
Okay.
And the Russians are going to use it to retake past territory, and the Iranians are going to take over the Saudis and the rest of the Middle East.
Yeah, probably.
And what they're worried about is that holds Europe hostage, because Europeans are very weak.
Yeah.
And they are our kin, so to speak. They're very weak.
Yeah.
And they're dependent on that. And what will happen is the Iranians will develop an oil bourse. They're just like the Chinese are threatening to create a gold currency, the currency.
Sure.
The Iranians will create a oil-backed currency, and between them, they will destroy the value of the dollar so that it's no longer a reserve currency,
right,
which means we can no longer afford this military.
That's right, sure. And then international relations will become what it used to be, pretty dicey operation.
Right, so I'm not unique here. Every geostrategist sees the same future I do. We all think the same thing.
Yeah.
If the only people who don't are the people that get paid by the defense industry.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. You know, here's my final thought and question. I can't wait to get your reaction. It was 2016, end of 2016, that a guy named Dennis Tubergen called me up and wanted to interview me. And I was kind of flattered. I said, well, I don't know who the guy is, but he's really, really kind and very interesting. So he asked me, okay, what are you thinking, Tom? And I said, well, there's really one thing I want to tell you, and that's about it. I said, the debt service cost of the federal U.S. government is about, at that time, 2016, was about 12% of hard cash revenue, roughly 12%. And of course, 4 years later, right now, it's 15%. Now, it doesn't take a genius, right, to figure out that, well, it's growing, and it's growing pretty relentlessly.
Well, I mean, I know this, but I mean,
yeah,
every economist knows it doesn't mean anything.
Well,
it really doesn't. I mean, a place like the United States with our economic value, we can inflate our way out of that tomorrow.
Yeah.
So we probably will without even trying. So it doesn't really matter.
So you're saying that it really doesn't matter what the numbers are?
It doesn't matter what the numbers are. No.
Yeah.
The real issues are that we need to redomesticate an awful lot of industries.
Yeah.
Which will cause an increase in prices.
Yeah.
But allow for an increase in wages, which will lower nonsense consumption and raise quality consumption.
Okay.
And then we will have them. We need to do that first. And then I already know what the government has to do to fix the banking system, and I've already written a proposal for it. So I mean,
see. Okay.
The part I talk about least is my economic proposals, but it's probably the one everybody wants to understand, everybody would like the most. And it's just the way out of this for us is relatively easy. The problem is we can't continue to export. We can't continue to export economic advantage,
okay,
and we can't import people to take away our genetic advantage. Our genetic advantage becomes our social advantage, what becomes our political advantage, mm-hmm, which becomes our military and strategic and economic advantage.
Yeah.
So we've got to stop the import of people below 115, which is all they're importing.
Yeah.
And they're doing it so that they can continue their plan of destroying Western civilization from within,
yeah,
by use of the blacks in order to immigrate more people to displace whites, use the tax whites out of their ability to reproduce, and therefore destroy Western civilization's power and turn the West into another version of the Middle East and South America.
Yeah.
It's not like they don't know what they're doing. They do.
Yeah. No, well, we're on our way. Yeah. Well, Kurt, tell you what, I think that's a good place to end. I think it's really fascinating. And why don't I give you a call in like 5-6 days or so, and we can
better
do
it. Just telling you, it's better for my schedule if you just find time sooner and set that up.
Okay, that's fine.
I have to do this daily with quite a few people.
Okay.
I'm producing content. So.
Okay, great. I'll call you sooner. All right. Thanks so much, Kurt. I appreciate time. Bye-bye.